Welcome to Media Law and Ethics, a podcast series from the School of Communication at Radford University. I'm Professor Bill Kovarik, and I'm serving as your guide through this course. This is the eighth in our podcast series out of 10 for the course. Today we'll be talking about obscenity, indecency, and the law, and the long-standing social debate around these contentious issues. Now, obscenity laws are concerned with prohibiting lewd, filthy, or disgusting words or pictures at both the state and federal level, and there are major disagreements as to what is or isn't obscene and what role the government should play in enforcing social or cultural mores. All 50 states have laws to control obscenity, and many of them are taken directly from, we'll see, the Roth standard of 1955. The Supreme Court has consistently held that the First Amendment does not protect certain classes of materials, including those declared legally obscene. However, the law does protect materials that may be indecent or simply offensive, and the issue is, what exactly is the definition of obscene? It's an important issue because, after all, people go to jail if they lose the case, and they pay heavy fines if they lose a case. Well, the confusion in the law begins with its foggy definitions. Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart once said in Jacob Bellis versus Ohio that he couldn't define obscenity, but I know it when I see it. Stewart's dilemma illustrates the difficulty for the courts in clarifying the ground rules. Another thing that makes it a little bit more salient, at least to me, is what Gloria Steinem said about America's obsession with sex. She said, "Sex is the Tabasco sauce that an adolescent national palate sprinkles on every dish in the menu." And you have to laugh. It seems so true sometimes. Okay. So, state regulations and federal regulations are rarely consistent. An interesting example of this is the partial nudity in official symbols, the state seal of Virginia, for instance, which shows the Roman goddess Virtus, dressed in Amazon garb, standing over the body of a tyrant, has remained exposed since the seal was designed in 1776. But the seal was apparently a little too candid for the city of Radford, Virginia, where the same goddess was given a brassiere, but strangely, an exposed midriff and panties. And meanwhile, in May of 2010, Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli from Virginia said he felt just a little bit uncomfortable with the wardrobe malfunction that the state seal had and proposed a new one where both breasts would be covered by a breastplate and was promptly laughed almost out of office. So these are the kinds of things that seem funny on a political level, but they can be very serious, and in history they have been actually very serious. Obscenity and pornography, of course, are found in many cultures dating back millennia, but usually were kept from public view. Some of the statuary, for example, in the Roman city of Pompeii was so explicit that it was kept in the back rooms of royal museums and were seen only by gentlemen who paid an additional fee. So there's always been a kind of a separation between what adults would see and what children would see. That's an important part of the ongoing debate over obscenity. The church persecuted very early books and engravings of an obscene nature in ecclesiastical courts, but by the time of Fanny Hill Memoirs of a Woman of Pleasure by John Cleland, published in 1749, British authorities really didn't pay much attention. Trade in erotic literature grew in the 1700s and 1800s to the point where London's Holywell Street, also known as Booksellers Row, and this is down near the down near St. Paul's and Fleet Street and all, was the home of 57 porn shops by 1834. These were all engravings. Obviously, no photos were yet in even existence because that came in 1839. But all had displays that attracted attention to thrill seekers passing by, and there were novels and erotic prints and etchings and catalogs and all of that. Now, this is also at a time when the streets and public health conditions in London are absolutely vile and disgusting beyond belief, and we probably wouldn't have been able to take it back then, feeling the way we do today about cleanliness and a certain amount of sanitation. Well, and there were people who kind of linked these two things, is the point. The Society for the Suppression of Vice and the ideas about cleaning up the city, the serious literal filth, along with the pornography and the obscenity, kind of all got lumped together. So there was a big reform movement, and it culminates really with the accession of Queen Victoria in the 1850s, and by about 1857, there's a Lord Campbell Act adopted to set a standard for obscenity in England. It wasn't really tested in court until 1868. That's how slow a lot of these social things moved back then. When a guy named Henry Scott is brought up on charges of publishing a lewd anti-Catholic pamphlet called The Confessional Unmasked. And it's part of a complicated piece of the politics of the era. But the point is that there was a standard that was set in the case called the Hicklin Standard. And that is that the test of any obscenity is whether the tendency of the matter is to deprave and corrupt those whose minds are open to immoral influences and into whose hands a publication of this sort might fall. In other words, in Regina versus Hicklin, the most important standard was the apparent influence on the most susceptible readers, such as children or weak-minded adults. And any publication could be judged obscene based simply on isolated passages, and the work could be considered completely out of context without any reference to social or literary or historic value. The U.S. adopted the Hicklin Rule in the 1870s at a time called the Comstock era, and this is named for Anthony Comstock, who was not only an enemy of obscenity but also of the woman suffrage movement and quite a few other things. Comstock was a crusading moralist who lobbied Congress for a decency bill, and his idea was that anything that had anything whatsoever to do with sex had to be immoral and indecent and obscene. So, for example, birth control, abortion, venereal disease, anything that involved even medical depictions of human anatomy were to be prohibited, and people who had them could be jailed. Comstock was named a special agent of the post office, was given free transportation to go wherever he wanted to enforce the law. And he bragged later that he was responsible for sending enough people to jail to fill a 61-coach passenger train. So the Society for the Suppression of Vice in Boston was called the Watch and Ward Society. And when you hear the phrase, or when you used to hear the phrase, banned in Boston, that's the group that had things banned. You know, among the things that were banned, Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, Boccaccio's Decameron, Rabelais's Gargantua and Pantagruel, Eleanor Glynn's 3 Weeks, Robert Keeble's Simon Called Peter, and many others. The H.L. Mencken's American Mercury was banned. And the influence of the Comstockery began to decline in the 1920s for a variety of reasons. Among them, ridicule, just absolute hilarity at the way they were behaving. George Bernard Shaw said, "Comstockery is the world's standing joke at the expense of the United States. Europe likes to hear such things. It confirms the deep-seated conviction of the old world that America is a provincial place, a second-rate country, town civilization, after all." people who fought Comstockery, like Victoria Woodhull or Margaret Sanger, also pointed out the inconsistencies in this idea that anything could be banned. And of course, Margaret Sanger published a magazine called The Woman Rebel, which fought this Comstockery, and she ended up having to flee into exile in England for a while and came back to the United States, was able to promote sensible birth control. She was a very sensible person, and would frequently appear in places like Carnegie Hall when she got back in 1917. Other people made fun of Comstock. Ogden Nash, a famous poet, wrote a poem about Senator Smoot. Republican Ute is planning a ban on smut. Oh, rooty toot toot for Senator Smoot of Ute and his reverend occiput. Smite, Smoot, smite for Ute. Grit your molars and do your dute. So, as always, laughter is one of the best weapons against tyranny. Now, two early decisions, one Mutual Film versus Industrial Commission of Ohio, involved the Supreme Court approval of a system of censorship of movies. At the time, movies were pretty new and considered to be pretty powerful, and the court said they might be used for evil. So that's the Mutual Film versus Industrial Commission decision of 1915. A victory for free speech was one book entitled Ulysses versus United States in 1933, and a judge found that on the federal level at least, and especially with regard to imports of books, the Hicklin rule need not apply. But what would apply? What was the standard that was supposed to apply in these situations? Now, after World War II, I think it's important to remember that a lot of people are tired of the paternalistic approach from government towards their adult pursuit of happiness. They're sick and tired of being told what to do. They've lived through very hard times. You have the establishment of magazines like Playboy and Esquire. You have the long, heavy court fights of Grove Press and some of the others. Great new documentary about Grove Press, by the way. And comedians like Lenny Bruce, all of these trying to break through the barriers, trying to get to the point where people can say and read and do pretty much what they want to. Now, these are not people who are trying to push necessarily pornography. They're simply trying to push the boundaries of a society that stifles their innovation and their writing, especially. Of course, in the case of Playboy, there are pictures as well. And those are the subject of a great deal of controversy. There are social liberals who are for a relaxed standard, and social conservatives who are morally outraged. So who should have the upper hand in a situation like that in a free country? Who gets to decide? Big question, and very, very controversial. Okay. So the very first interesting and large-scale case that comes along in 1957 is Roth versus U.S. And after that, there's a series of cases all the way through Miller, 1973, Miller versus California. But I want to hit on those two in particular, Roth versus U.S., 1957, Miller versus California, 1973. Okay, so in Roth, the court says that obscene materials are not protected by the First Amendment. Of course, we expected that, right? But the Roth standard formally replaces the Hicklin rule. So under Roth, obscenity is whether to an average person, not a susceptible person, to an average person applying contemporary community standards, not just any old standard, the dominant theme of the material taken as a whole appeals to the prurient interest. So in other words, something that is perhaps a pamphlet on birth control would not even come close to the standard. It would not be considered to be obscene. And even some of the milder Playboy centerfolds might not be the dominant theme of the Playboy magazine itself, taken as a whole, is not necessarily to apply to the appeal to the prurient interest. So there's a number of others other cases that take place. Smith versus California, an interesting one, Memoirs of a Woman of Pleasure versus Massachusetts, Again, this is the 1749 book that's been banned really in four or five centuries now. The original Roth test is to be applied in the memoirs case. The obscenity has to be patently offensive and utterly without redeeming social value. Utterly without redeeming social value. No social value of any kind whatsoever. Well, that kind of opens the door to a floodgate of all kinds of pornography around 1966, and there was a kind of a reaction to that. And so the Miller versus California tests of 1973, still the main controlling case in defining obscenity. So what is obscene today under Miller versus California? Okay, and that is, it meets the Roth test. So whether the average person applying contemporary community standards, the dominant theme of the material taken as a whole appeals to the prurient interest. Okay, it describes sexual conduct in a patently offensive way, and taken as a whole lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. And all of those points, artistic, political, scientific value, can be taken independently. So the question is, can a community then, applying their community values, ban something in one place that would not be banned in another place? Well, and the answer for the Supreme Court in Miller was yes. That's the whole point, is that different communities could have different standards. So you could theoretically have a town in rural Tennessee that would have a very different standard than, say, Las Vegas, Nevada. And what would be obscene in rural Virginia might be not really all that threatening in Virginia Beach. Well, even if it does make perfect sense to have different standards for different communities, one of the issues is who decides within those communities. So in Pope versus Illinois, which is one of the third really big case after Hicklin, you've got Roth, you've got Miller, and you've got Pope versus Illinois, 1987. So the issues in Pope have to do with whether or not a community standard is an exclusive standard, whether there's a national perspective that needs to be brought in as well. Just because people in one community may not like something doesn't necessarily mean that it can be made obscene in that one community. In fact, the community standard at Miller is modified by a national perspective. In practice, it means that prosecutors and jurors can call in experts to help determine whether something has serious artistic or social or political or literary value. Another part of Pope versus Illinois that comes up from time to time is the idea expressed by Justice Scalia that it's pointless to try to litigate morality, that you can't set a standard for these sorts of things, and so different places can regulate via time, place, and manner restrictions, which is pretty much what we've ended up with. So a time, place, and manner restriction would be perfectly legitimate in a town that wanted to keep its red light district and low rent bookstores in one particular place and not allow them to be, through zoning laws, and not allow them to be placed next to the churches or the university, for example. So that would be the impact of Pope versus Illinois. We've already talked about FCC versus Pacifica, which is one of the other big cases in this area. I want to mention one more thing, Reno versus ACLU, which is one of the big cases of the 20th century in media law. What's really important about Reno versus ACLU is that the Internet and the World Wide Web come out as having full First Amendment protection, just like the print media, and are not regulated like radio and television broadcasting. So the backstory is that in 1996 there is the Communications Decency Act, and in the CDA are provisions that very strictly limit the kinds of discussions and the kinds of images that can be portrayed and held on the World Wide Web and on the Internet. And a lot of people said that these were inserted by opponents of the of regulation in order to make regulation seem so onerous and so ludicrous that it wouldn't be undertaken. Others said, no, it's all because they're trying to keep all kinds of indecency off the internet. However, the run-up to the legislative follies took place. By the time the act was passed, the CDA was actually declared dead in the water. And the Supreme Court upheld that idea, basically saying that it might be within a government's power to set time, place, and manner restrictions on obscene communications, and that obscenity didn't have First Amendment protection. The CDA itself had a bunch of problems. Outright regulation of all kinds of indecency was overly broad, and there were plenty of other very effective methods for preventing minors from obtaining access to communications on the internet that might have been adult in nature. The breadth of the CDA coverage was unprecedented. It had open-ended prohibitions, not only on commercial speech and commercial entities, but all kinds of nonprofit entities and individuals posting indecent messages in the presence of minors. So it was an attempt to almost return to the Hicklin rule. And the Supreme Court, it was not surprising when the Supreme Court found that the law was not narrowly tailored enough to be constitutional, and some of the objectives of the law actually could be attained through other far less invasive means. And so the bottom line on indecency and obscenity really is the question of how far is the government going to go in which of the different kinds of media to protect children, minors, and others who might be the most susceptible from exposure to indecency and obscenity. Clearly, over-the-air broadcasting involves an involuntary exposure. Changing channels is an involuntary exposure where children can actually have access to anything that might be on the air. And this was the problem in the Pacifica case. On the other hand, in terms of print, in terms of what's on the World Wide Web, you have to actually know where to go and what to do and what to buy in order to get to those sorts of things. And so those are considered to be adult and not accessible by children. That's part of the issue. The other part of the issue is what is overly broad and what is narrowly tailored, and how do you define overall obscenity? And in many ways, it's so difficult to do that the courts don't really try to control the moral climate of the country anymore. They simply try to control the excess, the extreme excess. For instance, child pornography, which is blatantly and outright illegal to even possess. And so that obviously is controlled in the interest of the minors who are involved in that. But as far as consensual adults, as far as depictions of adult themes, as long as children aren't inadvertently exposed, the courts have been content to let the cultural debate go forward and let people try to figure this out for themselves. I want to say as a kind of closing point that there is an interesting case, Hadnut versus American Booksellers, 1986, that is and also U.S. versus Robert Allen Thomas, 1996, that could be considered to be cutting-edge cases in that they raise questions that are not really answered today and still are the subjects of debate. Hadnut is one that says basically women are being used as submissive objects for conquest and domination in some of these obscene websites and magazines, and it's an offense against the civil liberties of women in general. And so that's part of the debate. Another part of the debate in U.S. versus Robert Allen Thomas has to do with the idea of what is a community in the digital age. Obviously, if Miller falls back on the idea of community standards, that's fine if we're talking about geographic communities. What about the idea of virtual communities? How does that work? So those are two areas, civil rights and community standards, that are still really unsettled in the law. And I'm sure there's a number of others that we haven't covered as well, but it's a good place to leave it. Big cases here, again, just in recap, Reno versus ACLU, Fox versus FCCC, FCCC versus Pacifica, Pope versus Illinois, Miller versus California, and Roth versus U.S., and of course, Regina versus Hicklin. Okay, see you next time. Thank you.